Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
But I also would like to say that integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. That brings me to this. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point? That would be another question.
I'm James Wyrick, and you're listening to Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who serve and protect our nation.
The Army has named a general officer to lead its investigation into the case of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Major General Kenneth Dahl will lead the probe. General Dahl's mission will be to ascertain facts about the sergeant's disappearance and capture back in June of 2009 from an outpost in Afghanistan. The Army says its top priority, however, remains Bergdahl's health and reintegration. Bergdahl returned to the States last week and is recovering at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me again for another episode of Military Justice. Those new to the show, welcome. Those returning listeners, thank you for coming back. Today's episode is going to be a little bit different than the past couple episodes. And that's both because of my internal reflections and a lot of feedback from the listeners and getting yelled at by one of my mentors. More about her later. But for this show, I'm going to give more of a lecture and study guide for a specific issue within the UCMJ. This is going to be about investigations, how and crimes are investigated under the UCMJ. And I'm doing this because the last two episodes I've had guests and interviews. And there's an inherent tension during an interview. How much do you want to stop the flow of the interview to explain certain subjects? And I think I erred on the side of not giving enough explanation. I've heard that from you, the listeners, and my mentor. So I'm going to make up for that with a few episodes that are just focused on individual subject matter. Today, we're going to talk about investigations of crimes under the UCMJ. That's the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The UCMJ is the law that governs military justice passed by the U.S. Congress. There are reams and reams of implementing directives and instructions that put the kind of bare bones of the UCMJ into practice. For example, really, there's not a lot of guidance in the UCMJ about how investigations are to be done. There's some language in the implementing regulations about an obligation, the inherent obligation of service members to report known violations of the UCMJ, as well as general guidance for military commanders to make or cause to be made a preliminary inquiry into charges or suspected offenses under the UCMJ. As you can tell, that's really general. And there's not enough commanders to investigate the crimes. Not that there's a lot of crime in the military. The military community in large is pretty law-abiding. Nonetheless, there's There are a lot of people in the U.S. military, so there are crimes that have to be investigated. And commanders simply couldn't do that. So we have a number of pre-existing entities that investigate crimes and ways of investigating crimes. To illustrate this, I'll use a fictitious crime. We'll say it's a bank robbery. We're at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton. Huge base in Southern California, Oceanside, California. But we could also be talking about Andrews Air Force Base. We could be talking about Fort Belvoir for the Army. Or we could be talking about Naval Air Station North Island for the Navy. Short aside for you Navy types, you know that Coronado isn't an island. It doesn't have water all the way around it, but you should look into changing the name of that installation. Okay, so back to the scenario. We're at Camp Pendleton in what you would call Mainside. Mainside is a part of a base away from the training areas, away from the firing ranges or the flight line or the docks and the ships. Mainside has a lot of the housing area and a lot of the amenities that a base would have. You would have a commissary and an exchange. Those are the grocery and department stores aboard military bases. You would have barbershops, Subway restaurants, Jiffy Lube, that type of thing, and banks. So under this scenario, we have a bank robbery going on. So the person seeing this bank robbery would just see, presumably, we'll make this for purposes of discussion, no sexism here, but it is a man, an adult man, robbing the bank at Camp Pendleton, California. So the only guidance you're given from the UCMJ is to report all known offenses to the commander and to the commander's required to make an investigation of those. But if you take Camp Pendleton, it's huge, massive. There are multiple commands there. You have 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, 1st Marine Division, 1st Marine Logistics Group, part of the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing. You've got a Navy hospital. So you have probably 50 commanders, thousands and thousands of Marines and sailors there. So you can't very well just call up the first commander you think of and say, hey, it could be that your Marine or sailor is robbing a bank. So what you do is the same thing you do anywhere else in the United States. You call 911.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
A quick aside here also. I really need to thank everybody. There are a lot of foreign listeners to this podcast. Amazing number of foreign listeners, and I really thank you for listening. It's enough to convince some Americans into listening to me, but when I have Scandinavians, Australians, New Zealanders, Brits, it really is an honor. So, just to explain, in the United States, any phone, cellular or regular phone, if you pick up the phone and dial 911, you're connected to the police. The same is true on any military base. So that reported crime doesn't go to the commander. There's already in place a 911 system and law enforcement that exists already on the military base. Generally speaking, there are two types of law enforcement on any military base, regardless of service. First, you have the uniformed police. Now, these are usually service members, men and women, age probably 19 to 25. They ride around in cruisers marked police or military police or security forces. They wear the uniform of their service, so a camouflage-type uniform for the most part. And they have on a duty belt, looks like most other law enforcement in America. So you're looking at handcuffs, radio, a sidearm, probably a taser, and then maybe a chemical like pepper spray or something. They ride around with that, and they wear a badge. They're generally taking care of the base, looking to just preserve good order and discipline, make sure people aren't speeding, make sure that no one's entering the base, and they're just general law enforcement. Each of the different services has a different name for this, but generally the same. Air Force, they call them security forces. Army, they have military police. Same with the Marine Corps, we have military police. Navy, Coast Guard, Masters at Arms. But they just do the day-to-day grunt work policing. And they also run the brig and confinement facilities for the military. So in our scenario, a bunch of people are at Subway. It could be other military members. It could be family members. And they see this bank robbery going on. So they call 911. So first on the scene in that scenario at Camp Pendleton would be Marine Corps military police. So they roll up in their cruisers, looks just like any other police car in the civilian world. You know, white four-door with sirens and lights on the top. And they take PFC Jones, private first class, they take this fictitious individual into custody. So they arrest him, they put him in the back of the car, and take him away to a brig. A brig is the Naval Services name for a confinement facility run by other service members. So after that, there needs to be a more in-depth investigation. This is definitely, in this scenario, he had a gun, he fired it, didn't hit anybody, but he was trying to rob a bank. This is going to be a serious crime. So there needs to be a more in-depth investigation. There needs to be forensics done. There needs to be possibly some ballistics done. There's evidence that needs to be confiscated and then stored. There needs to be interviews. So we need to call in one of the investigative services. That's not to say that those MPs couldn't do the job, but they're junior. They're young. They might eventually have the expertise to do it, but they would just take down their initial observations and conduct a report like that. So then each of the services has their own professional investigators. Again, sorry to the Coast Guard. I never mean any offense, but I've never worked with the Coast Guard's investigators. All the other ones I've worked with at some point and very extensively in some points in my career. So in the Army, you have U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command, known as CID, which is a little bit odd because there's no D in the name, but for historical reasons, U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command is referred to as CID. They have approximately 900 special agents in the Army, and I can be a little bit off on some of these, but I am 98.43% sure on this. In the Army CID, you have investigators who previously were in the service. For example, I worked with Graz for many, many years in Guantanamo Bay, and he had previously been an infantry grunt. He was just an infantryman, and then I think around the rank of E4 to E5, so the enlisted fourth or fifth rank, usually a sergeant, probably 9 to 12 years of service at that time, they apply to be members of CID. So they then become warrant officers and then chief warrant officers. Warrant officers are a specialist kind of in between the senior enlisted ranks and commissioned officers. They're usually specialists in a certain subject matter. They might be mechanics, they might be aviators, pilots in the Army, or in this case, they are criminal investigators. They're detectives. They leave their other MOS, their other military occupational specialty, at about the 9 to 12 year mark, and then they become investigators for CID. And that's all they do for the rest of their career. CID also has, I think, all of them, but I know they almost all, every CID investigator I've ever worked with at one point rotated through this. They provide the personal security detail for the Secretary of the Army, Secretary of Defense. So that's one of their missions. But for the most part, they are detectives. And they are active duty warrant officers in the Army. NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service. They differ. They're a little bit bigger than CID. They have approximately 1,200 special agents. And they are all civilians. So they are civilians that are akin to an FBI agent or any other federal law enforcement agent. You know, they wear a gun, carry a badge, go through training. They are professional criminal detectives. And there's, again, 1,200 of them spread across all Marine Corps and Navy bases. They also go out to sea on ships. And that's NCIS. Air Force has a bit of a mix, and I can't for sure tell you exactly what this mix is, but they have 2,200 special agents, and they have enlisted officers and civilians. And these are all members of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. So I've worked with Air Force Office of Special Investigations special agents who were officers, you know, captains in the Air Force, and also ones that were civilians. So they kind of have a little bit of a mix. And then finally you have the Coast Guard, and they are civilian, active duty, and enlisted, and they also have warrant officers. So they are also a bit of a mix. But all of these are special stovepiped organizations in that they don't work directly for the chain of command. But they are tenants on the different bases. So they have a stovepipe organization that goes up to the Pentagon or higher headquarters. Actually, they're all now headquartered down in Quantico, Virginia. And they're outside the direct chain of command. So it's a request by the commanding officer that these crimes be investigated. All of the different services have different implementing regulations about what they will or will not investigate. So, for example, if there's minor shoplifting from the exchange, someone takes a DVD or candy bars or beer, they might not investigate that. They have a certain threshold for their investigations. So in our bank robbery scenario, you would have NCIS agents who would show up at the bank, and they would conduct their investigation. They would talk to people. They would take interviews. They would take photographs. They would collect forensic data. They would collect the weapon, and they would take it back to their evidence storage facility. Same would be true in any other base. So after working up their investigation for a while, the special agents would usually, almost always, have a pre-existing relationship with the trial counsel. Trial counsel is in the military is what we call the prosecutor. So there's a trial counsel out there that's assigned to this case, this bank robbery. So the special agent investigating that, and maybe his or her supervisor, would likely come over and meet with the trial counsel. They might look at the investigation, determine the strength of the investigation, maybe recommend something different. For example, let's say they had the video from inside the bank, but trial counsel says, well, you know, we also, have you checked for the parking lot closed circuit TV and also get that video? So they might go back. The special agent, NCIS special agent, goes back, collects some more information, and then they complete their investigation, or for what they think is complete. Then they might brief. This doesn't always have to happen in exactly this manner, but this is a fair approximation of what would probably happen. Then they would maybe brief the SJA. The SJA is a lawyer assigned to the command, so a judge advocate, or in the Navy, what they call a JAG. They are the staff judge advocate, meaning that they are assigned to the staff of that commanding officer, and their MOS, they are a lawyer, a judge advocate, but they serve in the billet that is called SJA. So that's their position, like DA. It's just, that's their the name of their position. And the SJA is the primary legal advisor for the commanding officer. So the special agent, maybe along with the trial counsel, they would meet, see what the investigation looks like, and then determine if it's ready for presentation to the commanding officer. And then finally, they brief the commanding officer, otherwise known as the convening authority. Within the UCMJ, commanding officers of a certain level have the authority and the power to convene courts-martial. That means to bring charges, to bring someone to trial, either at a special misdemeanor or general court-martial, which is the equivalent of a felony. So that convening authority would eventually make that determination. So that's the person who really gets the outcome of this investigation and makes a determination on what to do. How that person makes that determination and the steps they must go through, that's going to be a later podcast, but just know that that's the completed investigation. That's where NCIS or the investigators kind of step out until they testify at trial. There's also a completely different mechanism for investigations in the military. Generally speaking, anybody can investigate a crime in the military. That doesn't mean they do, but anybody is able to, as long as they are assigned by a convening authority, that commanding officer who is serving in the position of convening authority. In the Army, that's called an AR-15 TAC 6. That's from their manual. In the Naval Services, JAGMAN, and that is the Judge Advocate General manual. So it's called a JAGMAN investigation. And these are investigations that can be done into criminal matters or sometimes even non-criminal matters that just need to be investigated. Now, going back to the Bergdahl case, we saw this happen when then Major General Dahl, he's subsequently been promoted to Lieutenant General, he was assigned as the investigator into the Bergdahl case. So he was ordered by the convening authority, that was General Miley at the time, and so he was given the parameters of his investigation and ordered to conduct this investigation. In the Bergdahl case, I believe Major General Dahl said he amassed a team of about 17 to 20 individuals that assisted him in that investigation. Obviously, that's not your standard investigation. This was a big, big deal and had a lot of moving parts, so he needed a lot of expert assistance. Nonetheless, Major General Dahl was still the investigator. He was charged by the commanding officer to conduct an investigation and report his findings. So he did that to the convening authority. Now, there also are a number of other instances where command investigations can be done into non-criminal or potentially criminal, but maybe not criminal investigations into matters that might not necessarily be criminal. I think the last one I was involved in my time on active duty involved a negligent discharge. And this was negligent discharge means a weapon went off accidentally or through someone's negligence. It was at Marine Corps Base Quantico, and there were the two duties. So every night at every command around the military, there's somebody standing duty, usually two people, maybe a junior officer, and then some mid-level staff NCO. So some mid-level enlisted personnel along with an officer usually stand duty. The duty has really a notebook, a weapon, instructions, and a phone. That's what a duty has. So every day, the duties change over. So the off-going duty would hand over all of his stuff to the oncoming duty, the oncoming duty officer. In this case, they were exchanging weapons. So the sidearm was being given from the person who had just stood duty overnight, given to the next person. And he was unloading it and showing that it was clear and that it didn't have any ammunition in it. And in the process of doing this, it accidentally went off. He fired it into... it's probably best thought of as a coffee can on steroids. It's this with an internal area for pointing the weapon into. So he unloaded it into there and it fired. It's meant for that. That's why we have those. So it goes off and is fired into there. No one's hurt, but it's reported to the commanding officer. So the commanding officer orders another captain. So that's usually in the Marine Corps, somebody in about 6 years, to investigate it. And then I served as the legal advisor. Really, you're just giving them some guidance on what to investigate. This accidental discharge didn't result in any sort of criminal action. There may have been, I don't actually know, but there may have been some sort of disciplinary action or some notation in that Marine's service record. So I just assisted in informing the investigator how to conduct the investigation. So that is, in a nutshell, the command investigation. So the command investigation and the criminal investigation are the major tools that a commander uses to investigate and determine what's necessary to later take action on under the UCMJ. In a later podcast, I'll go through the charge stage. So what happens after the investigation is done and the convening authority or commanding officer determines that this case needs to go to trial? How do we go from a completed investigation to charges that eventually land in front of a military judge? If you like what we've been doing here at Military Justice, we'd be so grateful if you could leave a review on iTunes. And if you leave a review, it might just be read here on the show. For example, OG Dizzle 73, quote, "Amazing podcast by a veteran who knows what he's talking about. Buckle up for an amazing ride," end quote. And just to prove that we don't play favorites here at Military Justice, I'll read pretty much any review. For example, Linda, quote, "Horrible podcast, boring podcast, unpleasant voice, altogether an F minus," unquote. F minus. These reviews are really important. It makes it easier for new listeners to find Military Justice. And new listeners means Military Justice can stick around a little longer, even with an F minus. So please go to iTunes or use the iPhone podcast app and search for, quote, "Military Justice." Then go to the reviews tab and click write a review. It's that easy. If you'd like to leave a good review, do so. If you'd like to leave a bad review, do that too. Listen, I read a review that was an F minus. I'm really shooting for an F plus here. So do what you can. I appreciate it.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Saved rounds and alibis. This is a portion of the show where I answer questions from you, the listener. Or at least do my best. First question is from Mary. Quote, I have a question about the redaction of classified material and the extent to which it may or may not hurt defendants. You spoke hypothetically about how the redaction process might remove the, quote, to or from portions of an email, leaving just the content. Or perhaps the name and nature of a source might be redacted with only the sum and substance of what the source said included. If there's anything I've learned from Undisclosed and Anand Syed's case, the devil is always in the details. And it seems like a lot of these details are redacted in military trials. If Anand were a military defendant, would Susan Simpson have been able to see the facts cover sheet? If the identity or source of it is concealed, how can they be questioned and their testimony impeached? If there are slight discrepancies in what can be called the metadata of discovery, but the metadata is redacted, how can those errors be discovered? Do you think military defendants suffer at the hands of redaction, or does the nature of most military cases not rest in the details the way many civilian trials do? Thank you. Well, thank you, Mary. And you have raised a number of very important questions there, and I'll do my best to answer them. First of all, when I'm talking about classified discovery, very, very few military trials have anything to do with classified discovery. And as you astutely point out from your listening to Undisclosed, that information would definitely have been discoverable, the facts cover sheet that Susan Simpson found. So that would be retained in the classified discovery, or that would have been disclosed. Classified discovery, like any other discovery, is subject to abuse. That's inherent in our system. That being said, I spent the bulk of my time on active duty on the government side, either as a trial level or appellate level prosecutor. I took my obligation to provide discovery very seriously. And I think the vast majority of prosecutors do that. But there's still the possibility of abuse. And I think one of the problems we have in both civilian and military jurisdictions is the lack of accountability for prosecutors when they do violate those discovery obligations. That's probably an area where we need reform. That being said, in the case of a classified discovery and a classified prosecution in the military, Mary, you should still get the same amount of discovery. The information is discoverable either way. So that to and from line in the Anand Syed case might not have been on that facts cover sheet. The to and from line might not have been discoverable, but for sure the warning was definitely discoverable. So I think you might actually have a little more protection in a classified prosecution, either in the military or the civilian realm, because as I explained before, the judge sees the redacted discovery and sees the original. So there is that check on prosecutors that might not have turned that over. the military judge has to bless it. The military judge says that it's adequate discovery or not. So I don't think that military members are necessarily at a disadvantage. And to your overall question, the systems are very similar. I mean, as you say, the devil is in the details, and all of that would just be as discoverable Brady material that we would call in the civilian jurisdictions, or just discoverable material in the military. It should be, it's the same standard. It's a constitutional standard. So either way, it would have to be turned over. I hope that answers some of your questions, Mary, and thank you for such a detailed question. And it seems that, again, the listeners are amazing for this show and other shows, but it's as though you're getting a law school education here. And for that reason, I really strive to answer questions well. Question number two from Constance brings up that point. Constance is asking the interplay between civilian jurisdiction and military jurisdiction. So here's what I'd like to hear about. Personnel do break civilian laws when they're off post. They speed, run red lights, drink, and get into fights, get into violent incidents, commit property crimes. How does that interface between the two systems work? Unquote. So she means the two systems, the civilian law enforcement and military law enforcement, and the prosecutorial arms of both of those. That's an excellent question, and I struggled with this. I struggle with it because there are written down policies, but it's unclear how much those policies are followed. I was very fortunate this last week. I went to IHOP and had lunch with a colleague, friend, mentor, someone with extraordinarily deep knowledge of the military justice system. She served 25 years on active duty, another 15 years as a civilian criminal defense attorney working in the military justice system, another at least decade teaching military justice at law school, and she's a wealth of knowledge. So I posed that exact question to her. How do I answer the question of what is the system and what is the policy for determining when a case will go to the civilians and when it'll go to the military? She looked at me and said, "Policy? What policy? There's no policy." And she wasn't joking. I mean, she was maybe making a little light of it, but there really is almost no rhyme or reason. I'll be doing a longer show on this question, especially about the Lauterbach case, because there's quite a bit of misinformation about this. If you listen to the military commanders testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, they will say that it's absolutely necessary. That commander needs jurisdiction at all times. We can't alter the military justice system because the commander must have authority to bring charges in every case. The reality is far from that. The military gives over civilian jurisdiction in large swaths of cases. For example, one of my final active duty stations in the Marine Corps was at Marine Corps Base Quantico. The standing policy at Quantico was anyone stopped on base with a DUI, if it was a civilian, if it was a family member, or if it was an active duty Marine, they would refer that case to the federal prosecutors up at the Eastern District of Virginia. Everybody. So a Marine is drinking and driving aboard the base. That commander didn't take that person to a court-martial. They let that be handled by the feds, which is really contrary to what they testified to before the Senate. There's another case that I think is really important. This is going to be the subject of a later podcast because I really need to go in depth on this. And it's the murder of Lance Corporal Maria Lauterbach down at Camp Lejeune. This case brings up myriad issues. She had previously complained about sexual assault. She claimed that she was sexually assaulted by a member of her command. It's questionable if that was investigated much. There definitely was the feeling that it wasn't investigated. And she was eventually found dead. She was found in the backyard of Corporal Loren. Corporal Loren also fled to Mexico, and he stayed there for a number of years before he was eventually extradited. And he was eventually convicted in North Carolina of the murder of Lance Corporal Lauterbach. This would seem like a case absolutely in need of military intervention. This goes to good order and discipline. This is a Marine possibly sexually assaulting, but eventually being found guilty of murdering another Marine. The Marine Corps did nothing about this. Made no attempts. And I know this for fact. The Marine Corps made no attempts to prosecute this case. They just handed it over to North Carolina. And there's no question whatsoever. The jurisdiction under the UCMJ does not have anything to do with physical location where the crime was committed. So if the crime's committed on or off base, doesn't matter. As long as that person is subject to the UCMJ, then the military has jurisdiction. In the podcast episode where I go into more depth about this, we used to have a service connection requirement that was long ago, but it's some good background in that it was later removed. So now it's very clear that as long as someone is subject to the UCMJ, that's all that matters. It doesn't have to be connected to the service or physically or temporally. It just means that they have to be in the military. So it's clear that in that case, the corporal, Corporal Loren, who was eventually charged and convicted of murdering Lance Corporal Lauterbach, the Marine Corps did nothing about it, which I think is pretty disingenuous when you hear some of the other rhetoric about how important it is that the military have jurisdiction in all cases. They were happy to turn that over to the state of North Carolina. Not saying that there's anything wrong with that. The prosecutors from the state of North Carolina did an excellent job in the case and seemed to have been very professional in it. But that's not quite the nuance that is testified to at Capitol Hill. So, Constance, I hope that answered your question. It differs from base to base, service to service, and case to case. There really is no rhyme or reason for when the military takes cases and when it hands it to the civilians. I've got to thank everybody who's behind making Military Justice. First, executive producer Dennis Robinson. You can find his Twitter handle in the show notes for this episode. Please follow him. He's currently engaged in an Iron Chef-like battle with Rabia Chaudhry. Next, the lovely and talented Brooke Giddings. She does all of the audio for this podcast, and I really couldn't even attempt to put this podcast together without her. Also, she has her own podcast that I can't recommend enough. It's called Actual Innocence. And it is the story of individuals who have been exonerated through the Innocence Project. In each episode, she interviews someone who has been exonerated, and they tell their story usually from their arrest, through their trial, imprisonment, and now what they're doing in life. It's really, they are very moving and important stories. And finally, there's my Uber producer, Dreadnought. He's always got my back. Thank you all. I look forward to talking to you again. Wyrick out.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.